My name is Claire Kremen, and I'm a professor and President's Excellence Chair in a number of departments, including Zoology, the Institute for Resources, Environment, and Sustainability, and I'm also a member of the Biodiversity Research Center. And I work on pollinators, which in the work that I do is mostly wild bee species. So let me talk about the solitary bee and what the solitary bee is doing. So a typical solitary bee would emerge in the spring, and I'm thinking of a female solitary bee. She might already be mated, possibly from the prior season. So let's say she's already mated, and she's ready to lay eggs. So what she's gonna do is she is going to find a nest site. Many solitary bees are digging their nests in the ground. So let's take one of those typical ones. She digs a nest in the ground. It's a long tunnel. And off of that tunnel, there's different little alleys, blind alleys that she digs, and digs a sort of cavity to put a pollen ball inside and then lay an egg on top. So when she's got this tunnel with the blind alleys off of it and the little nest sites, she's gonna go out and collect pollen. And so she'll do that until she's got enough pollen, which she stores in usually in special structures on her hind leg. She brings that pollen back to the nest and just goes out repeatedly foraging until she creates a pollen ball. Then on top of that pollen ball, which she moistens with nectar to keep it in a kind of nice lump, she'll lay an egg, and then she'll seal off the entrance to that little blind alley. And she'll then continue doing that until she's created pollen balls and laid eggs in all of the blind alleys of the nest. And then she'll seal up the whole nest and she'll leave. And that's it. No, she doesn't take care of the babies at all. She's already given them everything they need. So down in one of these blind alley tunnels, the babies will ultimately hatch, and they'll start chewing on the pollen ball, and they'll go through a successive molts, which means that they shed their outer hard outer skin and get bigger. Then they eat some more, shed their hard outer skin and get bigger until eventually they get to big enough, and then they're gonna turn into a pupa, where they undergo metamorphosis. So they change from a sort of grub-like or caterpillar-like form to what you think of as a six-legged, four-winged insect with big compound eyes. Once the pupa has undergone this quiescent phase and metamorphoses again into the adult bee, and then that bee will crawl up through the tunnel and dig its way out of these plugged entrances, and it'll come out at the right time of year to repeat the cycle. So it'll then, you know, come out, get mated, and continue with its life. They're a fascinating set of organisms that vary hugely in many aspects of their biology, from how they nest. We talked about them nesting in the ground, but some species nest in holes in dead wood, or they'll bore into wood or bore tiny cavities into soft pithy, the soft pith of twigs and reeds and things. Some of them even nest in structures like snail shells, and you know, it's fascinating how they've radiated into all of these different niches. And then they also differ greatly in how specialized they are on different kinds of pollens. So some of them will only use one type of pollen for their nests, in other words, to feed their larvae, whereas others will use many, many different types of pollen. And they vary a lot in how they collect that pollen and how they carry it. I mentioned they usually carry it on their back leg, but there's a whole family of bees that carry it on specialized hairs on their abdomen. So, you know, there's just lots of fascinating things about these tiny creatures. They vary hugely in their colors. There can be bright green, iridescent blue, brown and yellow. They can be furry or they can be not furry. Anyway, they're just a fascinating set of species. I think a lot of the historic relationships do revolve around relationships with social bees, like the honeybee. I'm not a deep student of this, but I think that back in the pyramids, for example, of Egypt, they find hieroglyphics that show people tending honeybees And they also have pottery urns filled with honey that were left for the embalmed people in the pyramids. So it definitely goes back at least that far, if not further, that relationship of tending bees. And there have been different kinds of structures that people have used to tend bees. The very simplest would have been just simply taking a cavity in the wood where maybe a beehive already was and bringing it and placing it somewhere and, you know, being able to tend the bees in that way. There are other kinds of honeybees, different species in Asia. And for many, many thousands of years, indigenous people have come up with very inventive ways of collecting the honey. Quite dangerous, because these bees make these huge open combs way up on cliffs. And so people had to learn how to scale those cliffs and calm the bees long enough to get these huge, huge combs down. But there's just an enormous amount of honey. And there's some wonderful films that document this. Still goes on today. A healthy pollination process means having sufficient pollinators around. And it turns out that there's a variety of circumstances in which we know that having different species around actually improves pollination. I can give you a couple of examples. So it can be the number of individual pollinators, but also the different types of pollinators. So strawberry is actually a great example. Strawberry, when you think about a strawberry, you know, it's got all these little kind of dimples in it. Well, it's actually a multi-seeded fruit, meaning that there's lots of ovules that need to get pollinated to produce a nice fruit. So if you have only honeybees, for example, pollinating strawberry, some studies have shown that the honeybee will come and land on sort of on the top part of the flower. And so it'll pollinate if you look at a strawberry flower, it's got these white petals and it's got this sort of yellow cone-like thing in the middle, which is where all the ovules are. The honeybee will land on the top. And now that cone-like thing is going to develop into a strawberry. You think of the strawberry tip and the strawberry base. So the honeybee would be landing at sort of where the tip is. But if only the honeybee comes, then all of the ovules around the lower part of the flower might never ever get visited and might not ever actually develop the fruiting parts of the strawberry. So the strawberry will end up being kind of deformed looking. Only part of it actually got pollinated. There's these other bees called sweat bees that are very small, and they tend to like to go into a strawberry flower and kind of literally crawl around the base of that yellow comb-like piece that I mentioned to you. And they pollinate that part. So there's this complementarity based on body size between the honeybee and these other bees. And with all of them, you get a more complete pollination and you get a nice plump strawberry. The thing is that 75% of our crops do improve production based on the visits of animal pollinators. And what that means, if we go back to our strawberry, for example, strawberries, there are some varieties that can self-pollinate. So they can produce a crop maybe without any visits at all. But there's many varieties that are going to have improved production with cross-pollination. There are a few crops like, squashes, for example, melons, that never self-pollinate. They're absolutely dependent on animal pollinators. The problem with monoculture farming for bees is that, there's two main problems. The first one is that monoculture farming tends to really alter the habitat and the resources that bees need. So most bee species need a progression of floral resources, that is flowers that are blooming throughout their own adult life cycle, the time in which they're out collecting resources. So when you have a monoculture, if it's a crop that is pollinator attractive, like sunflower, for example, then there's lots of those resources available, but they're only available for a very short time window. Usually in any given location, those resources might only be available for a couple of weeks. And after that, the crop is harvested, or it stops blooming and those resources aren't available. Now in a monoculture farm, it's one crop. So there's just a lot of uniformity in the timing of when that's blooming. And often they use herbicides to get rid of competing plants. So there aren't any flowering weeds nearby either that could provide resources at different times from when the crop is blooming. So the first problem is the loss of floral resources. The second way that monoculture affects bees negatively is that it also can get rid of any nesting resources. And by nesting resources, I mean ground that is not disturbed frequently and that can be used by the ground nesting bees, or sources of woody material that the bees can nest in if they are above ground nesters that use either cavities, pre-existing cavities in wood, or they create their own cavities. So the nesting resources are often also eradicated during monoculture farming. Then the third problem is the heavy use of pesticides. The neonicotinoids are important to mention among all the pesticides because of a couple of reasons. First of all, they're extremely widespread. They've pretty much taken over the pesticide market. I'm not sure exactly what the percentage is, but it's something like around the order of 70% of pesticides in use around the world are neonicotinoids. And why is this? Well, I mean, when they were first developed, they were thought to be safer than other pesticides. It was partly due to their mode of action. They were thought to target insects more than other creatures and to have actually quite low effects on vertebrates, for example. That has since come into question. And they were also thought to provide protection to the plant across its life cycle. The reason being that they are what's called systemic pesticides. They're water soluble and they're taken up by the plant and then they go through the entire plant and are expressed throughout it. And so that means that, for example, if they are delivered as a seed coating, then it means that the seed is protected and so is the seedling, you know, through to its complete development. And that was seen as a big advantage. And it is potentially an advantage in terms of crop protection, but it can also be a means of more widely distributing this pesticide to non-target organisms as well as to non-target environments. As I mentioned, it's water soluble. That means it goes everywhere. And it has, these neonicotinoids have been found pretty much everywhere that people have looked for them in the soil and the water. So it is concerning in that way. For pollinators, it's particularly bad because if this is a plant that is, when it flowers, is attractive to pollinators, it means that they will be delivered neonicotinoids in the pollen and the nectar. And that's where the concern has come, specifically around the honeybees, but also around our native pollinators, is that they are getting exposed to neonicotinoids when they collect pollen and nectar from these plants. Well, the best thing that you can do, I would say two things. In your backyard, in your garden, make sure that you have a variety of different flowers available for bees. And there's some great places to get resources on that. One that's fantastic for North America is the Xerces Society. That's spelled X-E-R-C-E-S. They have resources for many different regions of North America on what to plant. And it could be a combination of your typical ornamental plants, but also I favor planting native plants, but you don't have to. The most important thing is to have a mixture of things that bloom at different times and that bees like. The second really important thing is to not use pesticides in your own backyard. It's really possible, very possible, to plant vegetable gardens and ornamental gardens without using pesticides. Or if you do have to use them, you can use them in a very, very restricted way. And try not to, try to find out if nursery plants that you purchased are, if they're using neonicotinoids on those plants or not. Because sometimes while you may not be using pesticides, the plant that you purchased may have been grown using neonicotinoids, and those neonicotinoids could even still be present in the plant. So those would be my recommendations. I think we really can promote pollinators in our backyards. And it's fun too. because you can start taking a look at what you have out there and see how that changes as you put in additional plant species and have more flowers available to them.